Hello, loyal Continue Clubbers and Exy Beasts. We have got another treat for you this week. We are sprinkling loads of cool different things in the Press X mix to start the year off. And this one is particularly exciting because how often can you say that you've got the real one, Lara Croft on the podcast? Well, not often, but we can say that for you this week because feast your ears on this one because we have a conversation with the brilliant and lovely Alex Wilton-Regan, who is taking on the role of Lara Croft in the new version of Tomb Raider that is being made as we speak, which is very exciting. We also talk about Perfect Dark and its sad cancellation because Alex was, of course, set to play Joanna Dark in the reboot. And also we talk loads about her journey into acting and her experiences as one of the most recognisable performances in gaming. So sit back and enjoy this conversation with Lara. Sorry, I mean Joanna. No, sorry. I mean with Alex. I guess the obvious place, Alex, is that the place to start, was this always the plan?
No.
Was acting in games the plan? How did you end up here?
Absolutely not. Not at all. I did always want to act. So I always wanted to be an actor. That's true. Even when I didn't really know what an actor was, you know, I come from a very long line of very intelligent doctors and lawyers and teachers and, you know, heads of years at primary schools and that kind of stuff and accountants. And I wanted to be an actor. I have no idea why I wanted to be an actor. I don't even think I knew what an actor was, but I kind of just always wanted to do it. I was very creative and I always went to, like, you know, Saturday drama kids, like kids go to Saturday drama clubs that kids go to, sorry. And then I was desperate to go to a stage school, which is called Sylvia Young, which is very well known, which is still...
Oh, yeah, you wanted to go to Sylvia Young, did you?
I wanted to go, which is like, I think Billy Piper went there and all these other amazing people. Yeah. And my parents, being the middle-class professionals that they were, like, absolutely not.
under no circumstances.
Under zero circumstances.
Are you doing that?
Will that be happening? So I got them to agree that I could spend the whole of Saturday there. And I really did do... I mean, I did everything. I did dance, singing, comedy, drama classes, and just drama, straight dramas was always my favorite. Yeah. And then I had this pact with my parents who were just desperate for me to go to university. And I said to them, okay, this is what I'll do. I will get straight A's in my A-levels for you guys to prove that I could have gone to any university that I wanted. And then I will not go to university. I will go to drama school. And my parents, one, didn't think I would get straight A's, neither did I, to be honest. And two, thought by the time she's got her straight A's, she will have seen the light and she will become a human rights barrister or something similar. And I got my straight A's and I f***ed off to drama school. So, much to my parents' dismay. So, and then I went to drama school and then, you know, did all my kind of normal classical training. I did the Carlton Hobbs Awards, which is run by the BBC, which is still going. It is a fantastic initiative. You probably know about it, don't you? Because you
know what? I was just going to say, I don't.
You don't
that
know
surprises
about
because I know most of the things that the BBC does. But such a big organisation, they do all sorts of random stuff sometimes.
So they run the BBC Radio Carlton Hobbs Award. It's a fantastic award. All of the drama schools in the UK participate in it. And they send their four, I guess what the school considers, you know, their four best actors to represent the drama school at a national level.
Yeah.
And so you're there with, you know, RADA, Lambda, Drama Studio, where I was. They all come together with their four best people and you have a huge day of competitions. And I won two special commendation awards.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
Yeah, it was cool. One was for Shakespearean monologue.
Yeah.
And contemporary duologue. And then when I left drama school, I did all my bit parts. I got my stripes. I call that when you do Casualty, The Bill, Holby's. It's when you do, like, you know, your procedurals.
Yeah. Have you ever been in an Agatha Christie?
No, unfortunately not.
Well, you will. At one point in your career, you will. And can you please call me when you do? Because I bloody love an Agatha Christie.
Do you? Okay.
Yeah.
That's good to know.
I have you. I could see you as a murderer. No offense. Like,
I could see you as a murderer too. Take it in a very positive light, Stefan.
Take it in the spirit in which it was intended.
It was a very positive comment.
Thank
and
you.
Then when I was kind of doing all my stripes, but I wasn't climbing the career ladder as quickly as I wanted to.
Yeah.
I basically was like, oh, what about this voice stuff that I won these two awards for? Maybe I should try that. went out, submitted my voice reel back then on CD. That stands for Compact Disc, children.
Wow.
And I sent it off to all the, you know, the big agencies and eventually got an agent. First audition was Dragon Age Origins. Got it. The rest, as they say, is history.
Look at that. It's so funny, isn't it? Like, it's a sliding doors moment, isn't it, Alex? Because if you maybe, if you don't get that role, you might not, you might think, actually, no, I'll just stick with the ITV procedurals for a bit, you know?
I owe like a huge amount of my career to BioWare. I love BioWare. I will die on the hill of BioWare. You know, Side UK, who was such an influential studio in London, casting a lot of the AAA games. Martin Vaughan, who was there, Cine Dowling, who used to be there as well, you know, two big casting directors. And they kept calling me in, and I'm just super grateful, you know? And, and they allowed me to build this big career that I now have. And I've been incredibly lucky. I was talking about this last night with our dear friend, Jane Perry, who I know you know, the BAFTA winner, Jane Perry.
Yeah, of course.
And I was just saying, you know, I feel that we are so lucky to be in this position within the video game industry where we get sent these big scripts and these huge roles and these kind of titans of characterization that we get to perform. Because, of course, not all games are brilliantly written, just like not all film and TV shows are brilliantly written, you know, and not everyone gets to play the parts that we play. Again, same in film and television. Her and I were just talking about, like, we feel so lucky that we get these big characters that we do enjoy, that feel Shakespearean in their size, you know, and complicated and messy and flawed. And, you know, Aya, Assassin's Creed Origins, I know because you were just talking to Abu recently, like, she's such a great example of a really flawed but interesting character that's so Shakespearean in its scope, you know?
And when you got that first role in the game space, is that when you sort of turned to your parents and sort of went, oh, look at me, I've kind of, this is all working out, this is all it's working out. Do you know what I mean? Because there must have been, there must have been a degree of tension in your household growing up. Yeah. There always is with teenage kids, and you're often when people make decisions in terms of their career that your parents don't necessarily agree with, that always causes tension. Was there a moment that that dissipated? Yeah.
Tension and confusion, hun. Deep confusion, where my parents were like, so what are they paying you to do? Well, I go in and I scream at dragon, but then like, and it's a real sword or a pretend sword? I'm like, well, no, obviously it's a pretend sword because, you know, I'm in a studio, guys.
I'm not a heathen.
I had to, you know, there were a couple of times where I brought them in to watch some of the games that I was doing so that they could sort of understand what we were doing. But I think I have been surprised and humbled by just how, you know, how far I've been able to go in the video game space, how much I've loved and learned about the video game space. I think my parents understand it, but they, you know, they don't play games. They're not into that kind of stuff. They were very pleased when I was opposite Glenn Close and the wife, put it that way. That was their career highlight for me.
Right. So, then they can. That's the one where they phone Janet next door and say, "Hey, Janice, look,
you know,
this is what we've been doing all this time."
Yes, that's the point, you know.
So why was it, do you think, not to get too deep and meaningful, I suppose, but why was it, do you think, that acting spoke to you so much? Is it because you've been fairly tunnel visioned about it, right? It's like you, because I can remember chatting to Melisante, and she, you know, sort of came to her a bit later on, and she remember talking about her first role being a goat. But for you, it was like, oh, early on, he's like, oh yeah, Sylvia Young's school, get me in there.
I think it was a combination of I really wanted to be, you know, seen as a child and heard, that classic thing, you want your parents to see you and hear you. And then I always remember I felt very, acting for me is so freeing.
Yeah.
So there's clearly a part of me, you know, the way people can meditate, or some, like, you might go to the gym and lift weight, or some men will be really into basketball and they'll play basketball till they're like dripping with sweat, and you get into the zone, you get into flow.
Yeah.
Aside from, you know, desperately wanting my parents to see me and then realizing they were never going to approve of my choices anyway, so you may as well do what you want. And I say that with love. I say that with love because I have fantastic parents. But I get in, when I act, when I do good work, I get into this very, very connected flow state. Mm. The only other times of which are like when I'm meditating or doing some insane kind of, you know, you're at some insane rave at 3 or 4 in the morning.
Yeah.
You know, like really deep in the zone. And that's what acting has always done for me at its best. And I love it because I completely forget about myself. It doesn't matter what's been going over, what's been happening, you know, 3 minutes previous. When I'm in that space, I couldn't really tell you like where I live. I couldn't really even tell you what I had for breakfast. I'm so there and I just love it. It's like you put down the coat of Alex, you put down the shit of real life and you get to be someone else. And there is just nothing more freeing.
And that is true for you, whether you're voice acting or whether you're giving the, whether you're doing the physical side of it as well. It doesn't really matter 100%, for you.
100%. No, because what I've learned about, so first of all, just take it back one step. When you go to drama school, voice work is hugely important, or certainly it is here in the UK. I obviously don't know what American drama schools are like, but you spend a huge amount of time in classes that are called voice. It's just voice. How do you find your voice? How do you channel your voice? How do you use your voice? How do you protect it? How do you change it? And you realize through doing, you know, big, brilliant, bold, beautiful video games that sometimes if you're only working with your voice, you are doing the most incredible things with it. And it vibrates throughout your whole being, your whole body. And you are sort of, you know, kind of channeling something from the gods up there if you're doing it right. Like if all the good pieces come together and you've got great writer, great director, great actor, great studio support team, you're kind of channeling a bit of the gods. It's a bit like when you hear like, you know, monks when they do their throat singing.
Yeah.
Do you know
what
I mean? It's like, I can't do it, but it's like, hey, I can't do it at all, but it's super deep in there. And these men do it. And if you close your eyes and you listen, like it touches your soul. If you listen to the greats, you know, if you listen to Whitney Houston, like if you really listen to her, she will move your soul. You know, she will bring tears to your eyes with what she can do with her voice. People like her or Cynthia Erivo. And I think that with that regard, the voice is an incredibly powerful tool that we can use as actors. And I love that. And I work just as hard in the booth as I do outside it. I will leave sessions sweating with mascara stains down my cheeks from real crying. Because the voice is so powerful. It can, you could sit, anyone watching this can sit there tonight and just like go, oh, and you can feel it down there. And then you feel it drop down to, you know, your solar plexus, your belly button, your belly, like all the way. And you can feel yourself vibrating. Now, most of my work, maybe not most, it's probably about a 50-50 split equally, is peak app, which is obviously face, voice, body. And then voice or voice and facial capture is normally the kind of, because it's quite easy, you have a cage on your head and the mics and stuff.
That's a mad sentence, isn't it? You're just there with a cage on your head.
There's a cage on your head.
Yeah, it's fine. Just embodying a magician or whatever it is you're doing that week.
Exactly. And I just think, I feel really lucky sometimes. Quite a lot of the time, I would say, I feel freer on the PCAP stage than I might do on a film or TV set, because film and TV sets, and I've been so lucky, I've worked on some wonderful, very, very free sets, like The Wife with Glenn Close and Jonathan Pryce, which was directed by a guy called Bjorn Runge. And he's one of those very free European directors who, you know, one day we finished 4 hours early and everyone was like, what? Why are we finishing 4 hours? Like,
wow.
Because we have it. It is magic. It is perfect. Like, is there anything else? Oh, it is beautiful. You know, and I was like, okay, cool. So we've got it.
Okay.
So,
he says, we got it. You know, what can you do?
Yeah. So you do work with amazingly free directors like that and film and TV sets like that. But a lot of the time, it can be very constrained. You have to sit right there. You know, you can't move your head too much because it's a very precise angle for the camera. You don't want to lose your light. You know, a lot of it can actually be quite constrained. Mm. PCAP is super, not going to swear, but insert a swear word. PCAP is super beep free. You know, it's very, very free. I love that.
And Do you think that it's given the recognition it deserves in the world amongst your peers who maybe haven't, who don't do radio dramas or don't voice characters and things?
Yeah, I mean, no, unfortunately not. You know, everyone, most actors nowadays, I would say, do want to work in video games. I get a lot of questions about, you know, how do I get into this from really, really big A-list names that, you know, I'm not going to out them on the podcast. But if I said to them, you, their name, she'd be like, oh, yeah, I know exactly who they are. A lot of people want to do video games. A lot of people understand the cultural significance of video games. But it's no secret that video game actors are paid a small fraction of what film and TV actors are paid. It's no secret that we don't get residuals. We don't get back ends. So if a game grosses $1 billion.
Yeah, tough.
That has no impact on us. Yeah, it, like we don't, our talent, our time, our passion, our professionalism is not, what's the word I'm looking for? Recompensed? Is that the right word I'm looking
for? Yeah, I suppose so. In the same way as you are on telly or
compensated. Yeah, it's not compensated in the same way. Thank you. That it's not compensated in the same way that film or TV actors are. It's no secret that a lot of casting directors, and this is true throughout the industry, they will either stream you as a theatre actor, a film actor, a TV actor, or a video game actor. And it's very curious to me that an actor that is successful in any of those mediums is not automatically sort of, you know, auditioned for stuff in other mediums. Because I think essentially a good actor is a good actor, right? Do you know what I mean? Like, to a certain extent,
The skill is different, right? The media might be different, but what you the character creation, the work you're doing in the first place is the same.
Yeah, and Jesse Buckley, I've seen on stage, and is probably going to be an Oscar-winning actress. She's equally brilliant across the board, you know, as are so many people. Idris is as captivating on film as he is on a TV show like Luther, as he is in Cyberpunk, you know?
Yeah.
So it's curious to me that casting directors haven't tapped into that yet.
And that's still the case, Alice. You're not seeing that change at all. Because I can remember, I've been doing this, we started covering video games in 2015 and having similar conversations then. And there was a sense of, oh, no, that's going to change because you're seeing all these different actors doing it. But you still get a sense of all these years later, actually, we're still in our prejudice in terms of video game performers.
I think yes. I mean, I tell you who I tip my hat to. I really tip my hat to the Baldur's Gate 3 guys. Mm. And I really tip my hat to people like Ben Starr and Erika Ishii, who understand that they have value and they understand their significance within the video game community. And they have brought themselves front and center to the conversation by using social media. In a way that certainly like I haven't really quite been able to get myself to do that yet. And in a way that I didn't understand until quite recently. Hmm. And in a way, like, this might sound really ridiculous because I'm on your podcast and I'm about to play Lara Croft. So just bear with me as I go through this story. But it's like, I didn't realize that I was a big deal in the video game industry until people like Ben Starr, who I watched become a big deal, would meet me at an awards thing or something. You know, he's like, mate, you're a legend. Like you're incredible. And I was like, really? And I obviously knew who Ben was from watching him rise.
Yeah.
Without understanding that, like, sometimes my work had inspired other people that this was possible, you know? Meeting Erika Ishii for the first time during this award season, you know, meets me, comes up, screams in my face, hugs me and calls me an icon with all of this wonderful energy that they have. And I was like, but you're an icon. And they're like, no, but you're an icon. And it's only from people doing that that you realize, oh, yeah, maybe I have had a sort of I have had a significant impact on people at points. But because I wasn't really utilizing social media, and because traditionally video game companies do not promote their talent, I hadn't felt that impact personally.
So that's interesting. So there was a role in for games as an industry to try and make stars to compete with Hollywood rather than try and steal Hollywood stars.
Oh my God, I'm going to steal that for my next interview. That's really good. Yeah, the way that you said that.
I'll take 12%.
You take 12%. It's 12.5 if you want to know
okay,
the exact
fine.
Number.
Okay, good. That's good.
But that, yes, there is a space for games companies to make their own stars rather than stealing them from Hollywood. Remember, also, we cost a lot less money, guys. So don't want to save yourself some money. But actually, in all seriousness, there was one other thing that was going to come to me. What I found fascinating was at the Game Awards this year, seeing people's names across the screen. In particular, do you know who did it very well? The indie companies. Because the indie titles, they understand that they need to put, you know, Devra Wild, Ben Starr, whoever else up there, and people will scream because they know and love these actors and they want to see all this glorious talent and passion and power and professionalism they're going to bring to these roles.
Yeah.
And the indie companies know that it's smart to tap into that. I thought that was a fascinating, beautiful, and genuinely kind of long overdue change that is needed in our industry. I was super encouraged to see that at the Game Awards this year. It was really encouraging.
Now you mention them, it's just bizarre that it hasn't happened before, you know, some of these performers that have been doing such good work for so long.
Yeah.
If we go back to a little bit about just this journey, if we use that as sort of as a rough timeline for our chat, and then we can just hop off into different things as they come up.
Yeah.
So first role is Dragon Age.
Yes.
And you're in it, you're loving it, it's gone really well.
Yeah.
Does that make you then, as a performer, to say, you know, I'm going to focus on video game performing now? Or not is it you taking anything that's coming?
I felt so lucky to be working.
Yeah.
I felt so lucky to be working. I felt so lucky that I didn't need to waitress anymore. I didn't need to work behind a bar anymore. I could stop being a childminder in my spare time. So I felt
You
so
did
lucky
all the jobs then, Alex. Fair play. You did all of them.
Oh, yeah, babe. I did all the jobs.
What was the worst one? What was the one that made you think, oh, thank God?
Cleaning out the toilets at the end of a shift in the pub or in a restaurant is always quite grim.
Yeah.
And then seeing weird things like when a parent would change their child's shitty nappy in the beer garden, it's like, mate, just take it with you. Just don't leave it on the floor for someone else to clean up.
That's bad form.
It is terrible form. Thank you, you know. So that was bad form. And then, of course, everyone used to smoke, right, in all the pubs.
Oh, of course.
So you would stink.
Honking.
You would stink, you know. So I was just so happy to kind of leave all of that. And then I was so thrilled with the quality of the roles and the writing that I was being given. And I would say that was actually the point that I started to really focus in on video games more. It was probably one of the big turning points was Samantha Trainor in Mass Effect 3, because that was such a great written role. It was so interesting. And it was when I went, and of course, because she's gay, it was so interesting to me to be out there representing that as, you know, Sam's character being only a gay woman. I thought it was such a brave choice. So then I was like, okay, who is this BioWare company, having already done 3 games with them? But then I really wanted to know more. Do you know what I mean? But then I really, at that point, I really wanted to know more. I really want to be part of the next project. And I think that it was around then that I started taking it all more seriously, because I was just getting such a kick from it as an actor, as an artist.
Yeah.
I was like, this is great. I'm going in, there's blood, there's sweat, there's tears, fainted a couple of times, you know, because breathing too quickly. So,
all right.
You know, so.
Is it? I didn't think about that.
Yeah, there was actually the first time it happened was Dragon Age Inquisition. There's a part where the Inquisitor has to trek through snow and it's cold. So you start going. And if you keep doing that for like a minute, your body tenses up. You're not getting enough oxygen. And I just kind of went, hey, guys, and it feels like. And people were like,
gosh.
Is she okay? And I was like, I don't think I'm okay, you know. So it was, yeah, I would say Sam Trainor was the big turning point where I really went, I want to actively do video games, good video games, more video games. Start thinking about a couple of games you don't want to do. You know, you get offers for projects that you go, you kind of have like a weird raping scene in that game and I don't want to support that. Do you know what I mean? Stuff like that. You also have to think about the stuff you don't want to do. Yeah.
Have you found that, you know, with the industry in terms of like it's, because it's a younger industry, right? It's way younger than telly and movies, for example. And I know that some people get frustrated when you make a comparison to do them.
Yeah.
With those initiatives, but we do have to kind of make the comparison, don't we? Because that's what we're working towards, right? Have you found, because it's a younger industry in that sense, that there's been a lot of times where you're like, ooh, that's not cool. Why are we going for that? And have you been able to have those conversations and has that changed?
It's a great question. So, okay, the video games, yes, are a younger industry. And so in many ways, we have old and outdated practices that just wouldn't fly on a film and TV set. Your classic examples are, you know, actors are paid better on film and TV. They get their residuals. You always have highly qualified stunt people coming in, you know, and the stunt people get breaks. There's intimacy coordinators, all of these things on film and TV. We feel able to discuss them and we feel able to enact them because of unions like SAG and Equity. Then you have the younger medium of video games coming in. For me, it's actually a really simple circle to square. You just have to pass the contracts over. It just has to be the same rules. However you're treating actors on film, TV, and stage, that's how you should treat them on video game sets. That's my personal feeling. I think most people would agree. That is now filtering down, which is great to see. You can ask for intimacy coordinators. We have the best stunt teams on the productions that I'm working on. We all look out for each other. We all protect each other. So that feels very good. I find it really encouraging. A lot of the people that I now see that are our age or younger coming up in the video game world. So you've got a lot of narrative directors who are women. You've got a lot of game directors, you know, gameplay directors who are women. You've got a lot more diversity in terms of casting and characters and, you know, a lot more accurate casting, for example, as well. Like if you want just a really simple thing, having done some mentorship with some Black and Southeast Asian women that I've been mentoring for like 5 years now, but they're friends. They don't need my help anymore. They're all doing better than me. But, you know, a really simple difference of when they started, it was just, can we get a Black actress? And they were talking to me and they're like, we're not being funny, but like one of us has got Jamaican heritage. You know, the other one had Nigerian heritage. It's completely different. It's not the same. So even honoring something like that, like the difference between someone whose parents might have come from Jamaica and whose parents might have come from Nigeria, it's totally different. It's totally different, you know, and just differentiating that within casting, I think, is really important. But then what's fascinating is I do see a disconnect between dev companies that are really always quite lovely or have been quite lovely to me. And then potentially much, 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 much higher up. The people that I never meet or see or talk
to. The faceless executives.
The faceless executives, when it just comes down to, you know, a bottom line, a bottom number. Well, we can't pay Alex the same amount as the lead man because, yes, please do enlighten me. Please finish that sentence for me.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? When I'm doing exactly the same job as them. Or what's another one? Not telling me about really graphic sex scenes, you know, that I'd have to do. Like, I don't think that would fly nowadays. But what's interesting is I think I don't get the impressions that it's the devs doing it. I get the impressions it's pressure from higher up being like, you got to move faster, you got to get it done quicker. And that's where safety and standards obviously lapse. So that sort of answers your question for you.
Yeah, no, it's interesting because I just think as the industry matures, people think of it now as a mature industry, and it's making X amount of money, more money than music and film or whatever that quote was that we've used for so long. But it is interesting that you hear stories, not just from yourself, but from other performers who I've spoken to in the past to say that sometimes that doesn't seem the front end, shiny, glitzy industry that everybody loves and spends time with doesn't marry up with the work that goes into making it, if you know what I mean. It's like if you were to look at how the sausage was made, you would be astounded sometimes by how perhaps old-fashioned it is on the back end, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what's also really interesting is I do, please, Jesus, I hope I've got this right. I do see people wanting to listen more. I do see the higher ups, like they're definitely trying. There's definitely, there is a willingness to try and listen, you know?
Yeah.
I also recognize I'm in a very privileged position that I've played some very important characters. I'm in a very, very, you know, privileged position that a lot of the time when people come to me now, they might be a Dragon Age fan or a Mass Effect fan, or they've played a game. And so they know what I do. So I do get given a lot of trust from directors, and I do feel able to speak to writers and say, I don't know if that's going to work.
Yeah.
What I would say for anyone that's watching this, that is, you know, a writer, a director of video games, or wants to be, or even someone that's based in a video game company, whether it's an indie or a AAA conglomerate, collaboration is key. Collaboration is everything. It is always where you get the best work from everyone, your writer, your director, your actor, your producer. If you talk to each other, it's what gives you gold. You know, it's not about control and squeezing something so tight that you deprive it of oxygen. That doesn't work. You know, people love the Bayek and Aya story because Abu and I were such sensational collaborators on it, you know, as was the team that we had from Ubisoft at the time. I truly believe that collaboration is just everything. And I think that is certainly how I walk onto the PCAP stages in the spirit of collaboration. Absolutely. You know, everyone's voice is valid and everyone's voice is important. It really is.
Now, you've touched on some of your, one of your roles then on Assassin's Creed. We've talked a little bit about Dragon Age. You've mentioned, you know, Mass Effect, Cyberpunk 2077. You've been in some amazing games, obviously, that have helped you sort of cement this reputation in the industry as the person they turn to be the new Lara Croft, which we'll come on to in a second, because no doubt there'll be loads of people that tune into this thinking, when are they talking about Croft? cut to the chase, Powell. Get to the good stuff. And we'll come on to talk about Lara in a moment. But so lots of things have gone right, Alex, but we can sort of sit down and chat and not talk about one of the things that went wrong as well, right? So
I think I know where this is going. Go on.
Yeah, I mean, I was sad because I loved Perfect Dark when it was on the N64. I still remember setting up those laptop guns in the multiplayer version and stitching my mates over. And Joanna Dark, such a fascinating character. How frustrating was it for you then when that all went south?
It's heartbreaking. It was awful. I'd been working on it for... When did it finally get shelved? 2025. I'd been working on it since 23. So it was awful. Like it was horrible. It was gutting. Unfortunately, I found out about it in the wrong way. I found out about it in the press.
Did you?
Yeah, I did. When messages started coming through from friends in the industry. And then I actually had some very, very good and constructive calls with some men who were very high up at the initiative who, you know, apologized for not telling me directly, but then also explained that they were still looking for financing elsewhere, which is why they hadn't called me, because actually it wasn't completely over. It was very much a case of those 2 months where we were kind of waiting to see if it would go through with Take Two.
Yeah.
So it wasn't over until the fat lady sung, and then unfortunately the singing started and it was over. And that was crushing. That was when it really hurt, because I realized there was no hope anymore.
Crushing because you'd put all that work in, because you were hoping people would see it. What was the reason? Because for me it was frustrating, because I didn't get a chance to have a fun experience for 25 hours, whereas you put your heart and soul into something.
Yeah, crushing because... So first of all, I knew the story, like I really knew the story inside out, right? And I loved the story. And I was like, oh my God, this is great. Like people are genuinely going to love this. Second of all, crushed because I didn't get to relaunch an iconic character who I'd also known. Now, I'd never played the games when I was younger, but I'd seen them. I knew them, you know, I knew of them. I loved the character in terms of she was so much a Londoner. She was very close to me, to who I am.
Yeah.
Right. And so it was a lot of fun. And on top of that, we had a really great lead writer It looks fantastic. Also, remember, I knew the cast at this point. I knew who, I can't say who the other people were, but yeah. It was gold. It was gold, you know? And so it just felt so, I felt confusing emotions of like rage that they could pull the game so far, or rage that the game could be pulled so far into development. Heartbreak that we were losing this ecosystem of brilliant workers and brilliant artists who were coming together to, you know, build something so great. And a genuine disappointment of like, I feel like you just touched on it, right? I've had this experience with Perfect Dark that you're never going to get to experience. And yeah. I know how good it was. And I was like, you would have loved it. Of course. You know, so it was a lot of curious emotions. And I think the real heartbreak actually came when the kind of hope disappeared and we realized that it was not coming back in any capacity. You know, it might in the future if they do something else, but certainly, yeah, not this iteration, I think, which is really sad.
How close was it to being finished?
That I actually don't know the answer to, but
in terms of your work,
in terms of my work? No, we still had a fair old whack to go, but it also, it depends on how you define it in terms of like, I'd done PCAP for it. I'd done VO sessions, which were just VO sessions, which is when you do your lines of like, look out over there, get down, you know? So quite often you'll do the PCAP for the cutscenes. You do lots of voiceover, which I'd done. I'd seen loads of the gameplay. So I can't actually say how much was done, because also remember the way we get hired, we don't know how big the project is.
It's mad. It's so mad. It doesn't make any sense to me. But yeah,
I know that we'd done entire chapters where I could tell you the whole arc of that chapter, and I know where it was going as a story. But you know, it's not like we get a whole script like in film or TV, and then we can go, okay, we've shot 2/3 of the script, you know, or we're a quarter of the way through the script. It just doesn't work like that in video games.
Now you will be sort of coming at this from a particular perspective because you were in the thick of it. You were playing the lead character. You'd poured your heart and soul into the work that you'd already done for it. Compared to sort of other work that you've done, did you think that it would work? It would have been a success?
I was absolutely blindsided. I was so confused. I was 10 out of 10 confused. Like I was 10 out of 10 confused. I was blindsided. I did not see it coming. I knew that Microsoft had made cuts to other companies over the past year, but Perfect Dark had always survived. And then one day we just didn't.
Yeah.
You know? And I think maybe I thought we would survive. Why did I think we survive? I think I thought we would survive because it was just really good. And everything seemed to be working, you know, and everyone certainly, look, I see this much of the team. Of course, is that big. I'm seeing the writer, the director, the PCAP producers, but that was all working. And what they would send me to look at all worked. So to me, I just assumed it was, I would have put money on it going, put it that way.
Yeah. It just shows you just the cutthroat nature of the games industry especially at the moment, right? We get a lot of
brutal.
I mean, if it's interesting for a lot of people who listen to our pod or follow along, they, you know, games for them is a fun experience, a bit of escapism, is something cool to do over an evening or whatever. But I think it's interesting that you can't really separate the state of the industry and people's ability to go and spend the time doing fun things, because it does, you can sort of see the pipeline of stuff, can't you? And there's going to be a big Perfect Dark size hole in it now, I suppose, because of just how cutthroat it's all got with bottom lines and big companies owning stuff.
And please remember that just as in any industry, you know, there might be someone who's listening to this that's a mechanic or a dentist or a teacher or a nurse. Just like in every ecosystem, if you want a hospital to run, let's say you're a nurse, you need porters to take the patients to and from. You need cleaners to keep the wards sanitary and safe. You need phlebotomists to draw blood. You need nurses to check vitals. It's a whole ecosystem, right? It's the same with a video game. You know, there are so many different departments and so many people doing different things. And each one of those person has maybe a child to feed, a mortgage to pay, you know, a pet that they love, that they want to pay the vet bills for. So it does... it cuts very, very deep, these kind of massive acts of, I guess, I don't know, people talk about the word consolidation a lot, which I don't really understand because I don't work in business. But yeah. People always seem to throw this term around and sort of fear it, you know. Great art takes great collaborators. And actually the best video games that sell masses, if you're only interested in the bottom line, you still have to create a piece of art that's interesting, that moves people, that people find exciting.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? It doesn't have to be this traumatic story, but it does have to be either exciting or engaging. It has to deeply, deeply move you in some way. If you do that and you get that little secret sauce that makes something brilliant, that's how you sell millions and millions of copies. That's how you make billions of dollars.
Yeah, it was a decision that sort of really made me realize just how stark the choices are being made at the top end of the industry at the moment. And also just, we know video game development is expensive. Is it unsustainable? Probably. And it's in that top end bracket. So I think there'll be how it impacts the sorts of games we see going forward. I think it's fascinating. Let's do one more controversial or seemingly controversial topic before we finish on a high with your new Tomb Raider news. I've seen you share a lot about on your social media pages, Al, about AI's role in gaming and in culture more broadly. How do you feel about the use of artificial intelligence in the moment? And I mean, my social pages are full of AI slop videos all the time. But what are your concerns about it, or what's your take on the situation?
My take is AI is really fantastic if you want to use it to do mammograms on women and detect the earliest stages of breast cancer. Let's go save some women's lives. Let's go save some mums that have kids to raise. My take is AI is brilliant if you want to get the quickest way from A to B and avoid traffic because you got to get to your son who's, playing a really important football match that you don't want to miss. My take is that AI is great when used responsibly. But to use AI to try to replace art and artists seems to me, one, just not a very effective use of AI. And two, just it's so stupid. Like, if you're going to create these robots, let's create these robots, these AIs, to do the really boring stuff that we don't want to do in society. Let's use AI to save lives or do the really dull jobs that humans don't want to do, or the really hard jobs, the really unsafe jobs, like the robots that kind of go and clear up landmines in war zones once the war's finished. Do that. Don't use it to try to replace artists. I think that's absolutely nonsense. But Troy Baker said something very interesting very, very recently, which is AI can create content, but actually it cannot create art. It can try to create art, but it's not creating art.
Yeah.
And I think to add to that, I would say, first of all, I agree with his point. And second of all, I would say, yeah, okay, great. You've swept the internet for the sound of a woman laughing, ha ha ha, and you're trying to recreate it and steal it. You're stealing things from people. AI innately deprives the author of ownership over what they did. You can't consent. That's really gross and really weird, And I just think, okay, if you're not gonna protect us, be responsible with your AI tool, then I think we shouldn't be investing in your platform or supporting you.
Yeah, it's definitely a live conversation that's going on in terms of there's the impact on the art that we consume and its impact on people's roles. So it's a big conversation that no doubt you'll be having over the coming months and years, probably, in your profession, isn't it, in terms of its relation to actors and stuff. But let's finish on something a bit more fun and positive. Tell me about what happens when you get an email. I don't know if it comes from your agent or if it comes from the production company or whoever, and it says, so, hey, Lara Croft, do you fancy it?
So first of all, it was a call that my agent set up, not that unusual, Zoom call, slightly unusual, but I was like, okay, she wants to chat face to face. And I log on to the Zoom call and she's not there. It was the casting director. And it took me a moment. And I was like, why is Kirsten here? Why is Kirsten here? And I went, oh my God. And then I started screaming. I was like, but then I kind of couldn't talk because I think we were waiting for my agent to join the call. So I was like, hi, how are you? And I was like, this is either really good news or this is really bad news. And they're going to be like, you were down to the final two. But when they gave me that call, yeah, I screamed, I cried, I, you know, burst into a ball of magical fire and all the rest of it.
So you didn't have to like do an audition or put yourself forward for it. They were casting the industry and they picked you.
No, I had I had rounds and rounds.
Oh, did you?
Yes.
Oh, I thought you'd just. I thought they'd be like, no, we want her.
No. I mean, I think the devs did know my work, which really, really helped. They are all gamers. They'd played a lot of my stuff. So I think I was definitely a suggestion that they put forwards. But no, this was after four rounds of auditions. Sorry, I should have specified.
Wow. No, I should have thought about it.
No, when I had four rounds of auditions before I got the job. And so when I logged on, it was either going to be very good news or very bad news. And so that's why I knew the casting director at this point. And
yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
But is this version of Lara someone we can relate to in the sense of someone we've seen before? Or is it brand new?
Bit of both, I would say. And genuinely, I'm not saying that to be convoluted. I think it is genuinely a bit of both. It's sort of like, The phrase that I'm working with is no Lara's left behind.
Okay.
I like the idea of like no Lara's left behind, right? I've looked at all of the performances. Obviously, I've got all the scripts, so I know where it's going. Mm. And, you know, I think there's all of the Laras that have previously come before will also be informing this one as we move into a new era of Tomb Raider, I would say.
Okay.
I genuinely think that fans are going to love it. I want to insert a swear word, but it's brilliant. It's brilliant. I know what we're making. It's brilliant. It's brilliant. I think you're all going to love it. Wherever you fall, whether you're like, you know, the originals, the remasters, the classics, the Survivor trilogy, wherever you fall on that kind of spectrum, I think you're all going to love it.
Yeah. It's just fascinating with games, isn't it? Is that the gestation period of making a game is so long that you've got to sit with these. I can remember I had to sit with Secrets when I was making the behind the scenes program about Doctor Who. I'd have to sit with Secrets for like a long time. I don't know how you guys do it when you've got to sit. You're years probably until we're going to see some of this stuff, and it's all in your head the whole time. You've got to be on constant spoiler alert for the next 4 or 5 years or whatever.
Yeah, it's hard, but it's you know, there are some games in the business where actors call them, they're like, come on, friendy Amy, so NDA, but friendy Amy.
And
this is one of those games you don't friendy A. This is one of those games where you're like, I can't talk about, and everyone's like, but why are you in LA for so long? Because it's all shot in LA. It's all performance capture. It's all shot in LA. But why are you in LA so long? I'm like, so then it got to the stage where I had a code name for the game, name for the character. And I was lying to my friends' faces. And I was like, this wasn't the code. I can't tell you the code name because it's so cringe, but like, let's just say let's just say it was like Banana Moon. I was like, oh yeah, it's this game. And like, it's code name Banana Moon. And I'm playing the lead character, Banana. She's British. They were like, why are they getting all that? I was like, oh, she's British. So, you know, it kind of makes sense. And
yeah,
you know, but yeah.
Amazing.
And actually, wait, Stefan, can I tell you one nice thing?
Yeah.
I've listened to a few of these podcasts for Press X to Continue, but I specifically listened to your Lara Croft episode.
Oh, look at that.
And you had the lovely Claire Lim on the show, who I like very much, talking about the cultural significance of Lara Croft. And I think that was, you know, it really made me reflect, like, Lara is not a video game star. Lara is a cultural icon.
Yeah, it's amazing. I can remember I did a piece for BBC News website when I was full-time there, about 25 years of Lara Croft, and we had some amazing access to like early concept art of hers. And you're right, like the first gaming character probably to really cut between like mainstream, you know, British culture.
Well, wasn't it you that said she was on the cover of like over 1,000 magazines, more than any Hollywood movie star or supermodel?
She's quite the character. And so no pressure, Alex, to step into those shoes.
These are some big boots.
All the best. We can't wait to see it. And obviously we'll have to have you back on when we can talk a little bit more about it. But it's been a joy having you on Press X to continue. Thank you very much for being so open and sharing so much with us.
Thank you for having me. Bye, guys.
Well, thank you very much for listening, you loyal members of the Continue Club and you loyal XC Beasts. Now, remember to get involved in our conversations on social media, Press X Podcast and Press X Pod on TikTok and Instagram. Get involved in the Discord as well. Like and subscribe as much as you can. We should be asking you to do that more, actually. So please do all of that. And we will be back with you for another episode on Tuesday. Bye-bye.